content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading today from the December 11th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows it's two Iranian soldiers. They are in their full formal military outfits, and they are carrying, along with some others behind them, a casket. The casket is colored like the Iranian flag, has some Arabic writing on it, and has a picture of a gentleman. I believe it was the scientist who was killed. In the background behind one of the soldiers, there's a burning American flag. And on the other side, there's a man in the background holding up a photo that has both Donald Trump and Joe Biden on it. And that photo also is being burned. The title is Boxing in Iran. Will Israel's killing of an Iranian nuclear scientist block Biden's plan to revive peace deal? And we'll get to that in a moment, but we'll start with the first main story, which is titled Biden's Administration Taking Shape. What happened? President-elect Joe Biden continued to build his administration as he unveiled core members of his economic team this week with a diverse group of picks with extensive Washington experience in the Barack Obama and Bill Clinton administrations. Biden confirmed that he was nominating former Federal Reserve Chairperson Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary and named as her deputy Adewale Wale Adeyemo, a top international economic advisor to Obama, who'd be the highest-ranking African-American in the department's history. Biden tapped another African-American, Princeton University economist Cecilia Roos, a former advisor to both Clinton and Obama, as head of the Council of Economic Advisors. To run the Office of Management and Budget, he nominated Neera Tanden, an Indian-American former policy advisor to Obama and to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaigns. Biden, making his first public appearance in a walking boot after fracturing his foot while playing with his dogs, called them groundbreaking Americans poised to advance racial equity across the economy and restore the backbone of this country, the middle class. Biden also named an all-female communications staff headed by two Obama administration veterans, communications director Kate Bedingfield and press secretary Jen Psaki. Tanden was the first Biden pick to generate significant controversy. The head of the liberal think tank Center for American Progress took heat both from progressives alienated by her criticism of Bernie Sanders and from Republicans angered by her years of Twitter bashing of Donald Trump and GOP lawmakers. She stands zero chance of being confirmed, said Texas Senator John Cornyn. What the editorial said. Biden's economic team is ready to party like it's 2009, said the Wall Street Journal. From Yellen down, it's stocked with Obama veterans who believe in more spending, more regulation, higher taxes, and easier money. It's a good bet these Keynesian solutions to the lingering damage from the pandemic will be more federal stimulus and tax hikes. But once widespread vaccination begins, the economy should soar. The Biden team's job is to encourage growth, not stifle it with the same policy mix that produced the slowest recovery in decades the last time they held power. Biden's foreign policy team also faces a huge challenge, said Bloomberg.com. 4 years of Trump's open hostility to diplomacy has stripped the State Department of vital expertise, killed morale, and hurt our prestige abroad. Secretary of State nominee Antony Blinken is a career diplomat with a deep credibility around the world and an insider's knowledge of what needs fixing. He and his well-qualified aides will need to rebuild state with professional diplomats, undo President Trump's submissive dealings with strong men like Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, and convince allies that America is back as a world leader. What the columnist said. What a difference an election makes, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The difference between Biden's thoughtful, intellectually respected picks and the know-nothings and cronies that stock Trump's cabinet is like the difference between Major League veterans and T-ball players. The president-elect has shown a deft ability to thread the needle with nominees progressive enough to reassure most Democrats and reasonable enough to impress conservative policy wonks. Settle in for another installment of Night of the Living Dead Democrats, said Kevin Williamson in the New York Post. Biden has responded to his party's call for a sweeping social change with a tired hack pack of Democratic functionaries long associated with elite institutions, such as Blinken and perennial mediocrity John Kerry, his climate change envoy. Republicans may be relieved Biden doesn't seem ready to do anything out of the box, but those looking for bipartisan progress on issues of critical national importance are likely to be disappointed. Biden's picks send a clear message, said Julian Zelizer in CNN.com. Experience matters. For many years, voters have fetishized the anti-Washington political outsider who promises to shake things up. But over 4 years of ultimate outsider Donald Trump, the weakness of the anti-establishment candidate became crystal clear, especially when the pandemic struck. Voters have chosen to replace an impulsive president with a career Washington veteran who will define his administration by experience and expertise. And the second main story refers back to the cover drawing. Iran promises revenge after nuclear scientist slain. What happened? Iranian leaders were vowing vengeance this week after their country's top nuclear scientist was killed in a suspected Israeli hit, an assassination that could derail efforts by the incoming administration of President-elect Joe Biden to revive the Obama-era Iran nuclear deal. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who led Iran's nuclear weapons program for 2 decades, was being chauffeured to a town outside Tehran when he was shot and killed. How the hit unfolded isn't clear. Iranian state media initially reported that Fakhrizadeh's convoy was ambushed by a team of gunmen, but later claimed the scientist was killed by a remote-controlled machine gun. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani accused Israel of attempting to create chaos with the assassination and pledged to hit back at the proper time. U.S. intelligence officials said there was little doubt Israel was behind the attack. Israel has not commented on the killing. The ambush took place just weeks after the International Atomic Energy Agency reported that Iran now has enough low-enriched uranium to eventually build 2 nuclear bombs, a stockpile 12 times larger than permitted under the Obama-era pact President Trump abandoned in 2018. If Iran were to lash out against Israel in the coming weeks, it would likely blow up the proposed deal outlined by Biden, that the U.S. will drop nuclear-related sanctions imposed by Trump if Tehran returns to the nuclear limits imposed by the 2015 accord. Jake Sullivan, tapped to serve as Biden's national security advisor, said that reviving the nuclear deal is really up to Iran. What the columnist said. Israel was within its rights to take out Fakhrizadeh, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. Iran's unrelenting pursuit of a nuke poses an existential threat to Israel, but not because Tehran would launch a first strike. Rather, it's that Iran's other destabilizing actions, supporting terrorists, arming insurgents across the Middle East, will be much harder to deter if it acquires an atomic weapon. Did the Trump administration approve the hit? Asked Barak Ravid in Axios.com. The White House hasn't concealed its ambition to make it harder for Biden to renew talks with Iran. And just days before the operation, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also a foe of Tehran. However it came about, his killing will have no impact on Iran's nuclear program, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. The regime already has all the knowledge and technology needed to fashion a nuclear device. What it lacks is the material, highly enriched uranium. This assassination might actually force a diplomatic breakthrough, said Max Boot in WashingtonPost.com. An earlier round of suspected Israeli hits on Iranian scientists, four dead from 2010 to 2012, combined with the sanctions and U.S.-led U.S.-Israel cyber attacks, helped push Tehran to enter negotiations and sign the 2015 pact. It will be an ironic twist of fate if his death only adds to the pressure on Iran to conclude a deal with Biden administration staff by many of the same officials who negotiated the earlier agreement. The controversy of the week is titled Flynn. What does his pardon portend? No one can be surprised that President Trump pardoned Michael Flynn last week, said Elliot Williams in CNN.com. But we can still be disgusted. Flynn, you'll recall, was Trump's first national security advisor, whom he fired in 2017 when he was caught lying about his conversation with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Flynn later pleaded guilty twice to misleading FBI investigators about those same conversations, in which Flynn secretly assured Kislyak that Trump would review the sanctions President Obama had just slapped on Russia for meddling in the 2016 election in Trump's behalf. The pardon is another Trump insult to the rule of law, said Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Flynn not only lied about his dealings with the Russians, he also failed to disclose his $65,000 payment by Russia and $500,000 payment by Turkey, making our national security advisor a paid foreign agent. But as Trump's campaign to discredit the Russian hoax gathered steam, his right-wing apologist adopted Flynn as a victim of the so-called deep state. Now he's joined right-wing activists Dinesh D'Souza, former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and Roger Stone in the rogues gallery of crooks rewarded with pardons or commutations for being one of Trump's guys. Actually, Flynn's pardon is justly deserved, said Abe Greenwald in CommentaryMagazine.com. His conversations with Kislyak were standard back-channel diplomacy for an incoming administration, but turned into a Kafkaesque nightmare. Only when Special Counsel Robert Mueller, desperate for Trump team scalps, threatened to prosecute Flynn's son, did Flynn Sr. plead guilty. Protecting citizens from vindictive prosecutors and judges, mitigation from the rigor of the law, as Alexander Hamilton put it, was the founder's explicit goal in crafting the pardon power, said John Yu in NationalReview.com. And it does not contain an exception for pardons that appear to benefit the president. The Flynn pardon was not an act of mercy, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. It's part of Trump's attempt to save himself. Flynn's chat with Kislyak was in itself a crime. So why lie? The likely explanation is that Flynn, like Jeff Sessions, who lied to Congress about his own talks, had a sense there was some terrible truth about Russia that Trump would want to conceal, and that the campaign's frequent contact with Russians, a group secret, was lethally radioactive. Flynn originally agreed to cooperate with Mueller's investigators, but suddenly changed his mind and clammed up. Stone had his sentence commuted by Trump after being convicted of lying about his contacts with WikiLeaks and a Russian hacker. Former campaign manager Paul Manafort went to prison after also refusing to reveal the truth about his own Russian contacts. Trump bought their silence and a successful cover-up and is now paying up. Trump's lame duck pardon shenanigans are only getting started, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. Trump is reportedly mulling preemptive pardons for Don Jr., Eric Ivanka, and Jared Kushner, as well as Rudy Giuliani. Trump might even pardon himself, although he has no power over possible New York State prosecutions. Flynn's is hardly the first corrupt presidential pardon, said Austin Surratt in USA Today. Bill Clinton, for example, pardoned a fugitive tax cheat, Mark Rich, at the request of Rich's ex-wife, a major Democratic donor. Ultimately, the only check on this awesome power is the electorate. If we don't want presidents granting corrupt, self-serving pardons, we must elect presidents with the character and wisdom not to do so. In our Good Week, Bad Week segment, turns out it was a good week for self-defense. After a deer hunter in the Czech Republic had his rifle stolen by a stag who charged at him, somehow snagged the weapon in its antlers and ran off with it. Police said it was a scenario that a film director would not invent. It was a good week for the obvious after Merriam-Webster announced pandemic as the 2020's word of the year. That probably isn't a big shock, admitted the dictionary's editor-at-large, Peter Sokolowski. It was a good week for expertise with Dr. Scott Atlas' resignation from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Atlas, a radiologist whom President Trump brought in after seeing him on Fox News, decried state restrictions and mask wearing and applauded soaring infections as fantastic because they'd lead to herd immunity. But it was a bad week for the huddle. After all four quarterbacks on the Denver Broncos roster were excluded from a game against the New Orleans Saints after exposure to coronavirus. With play calling duties handled by running backs and wide receivers, the Broncos completed only one pass and lost 31-3. It was a bad week for Edison County, Michigan, which was cited as voter fraud hotspot in a lawsuit filed by pro-Trump lawyer Sidney Powell, even though no such place exists. Powell alleged that Joe Biden got 100% of the votes in Edison County. Finally, it was a bad week for returning to Manhattan. After dozens of posters were put up in the city featuring Ivanka Trump's face under the headline, "Not Wanted." The posters described her as fake posh with dead eyes and said she wasn't welcome to return. Before we go to the briefing page article, I want to read you a short piece from the People page. We don't often hit that one, but this one's interesting. The married scientists who created a vaccine. Özlem Türeci and Uğur Şahin are fast becoming the most celebrated married couple in science since Marie and Pierre Curie, say at Alice Thompson and Rachel Sylvester in The Times. Just 9 months after they went into action after learning about a new infectious disease in Wuhan, the German-Turkish founders of the research firm BioNTech unveiled what may be the world's first effective coronavirus vaccine funded by Pfizer. It's meant working around the clock, but that hasn't much troubled the pair. At the end of the day, the vaccine is also our passion, says Sahin. What drives us is the knowledge that there are kids who want to have a normal life. There's the mother, the teacher, the old person being isolated. There is so much need. The two medical researchers have been working on harnessing messenger RNA to fight cancer and knew the genetic technology could play a key role in fighting the coronavirus. Each has their complementary skills, and we try to synergize, Tureci says. It really is a privilege to work together. Now there's talk of a Nobel Prize, and their firm is valued at an eye-watering $25 billion. Not that money holds much meaning for the duo, who live modestly and only occasionally take a vacation. We do not have special needs, said Sahin. We don't even have a car. A yacht would be impractical. And we'll go right over to the briefing page titled Climate Engineering. Should scientists artificially cool the planet to stave off climate catastrophe? What is geoengineering? Some climate scientists are coming to believe it's humanity's only hope for slowing or stopping disastrous changes in the climate. As runaway carbon dioxide emissions contribute to melting ice caps, widespread flooding, prolonged heat waves, and droughts, apocalyptic wildfires, and devastating hurricanes, researchers are exploring planetary-scale interventions in Earth's natural systems as a way of counteracting climate change. Geoengineering has been debated since the 1960s, when the U.S. scientists suggested floating billions of white, golf ball-like objects in the oceans to reflect sunlight. Interfering in natural processes was widely considered naive and dangerous until recently, but as the window to curb global warming shrinks, proposals to reflect sunlight, shade Earth's surface, accelerate carbon absorption in the ocean, and remove CO2 from the air are being taken more seriously. In October, Silver Lining, a nonprofit, gave $3 million toward climate engineering research. I liken geoengineering to chemotherapy, said Michael Gerard, a professor of environmental and climate law at Columbia University. If all else is failing, you try it. What are the most plausible proposals? Silver Linings grant recipients are researching whether humans can blast sunlight-reflecting aerosol particles into the stratosphere, mimicking the cooling effect of volcanic ash clouds. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, spewing sulfate particles into the atmosphere that caused global temperatures to drop 0.6 degrees Celsius over the next 2 years. Solar radiation management would involve sending fleets of airplanes up about 65,000 feet, where they'd spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, or perhaps even diamond dust. A research team at Harvard University projects that if high-altitude tankers had the capacity to make 60,000 particle dumps by 2035, it would shave off 0.3 degrees Celsius of warming. What else is being explored? Another idea is to pump salt water from oceans into the air, forming water droplets that would make marine clouds brighter and thus more reflective. Australia is funding research, hoping enhanced clouds could cool water temperatures enough to save the already damaged Great Barrier Reef. Cambridge University researchers are studying whether ships can pump salt particles into low-lying polar clouds to help refreeze polar ice caps. Other researchers wonder whether seeding oceans with iron could stimulate the growth of marine algae, which soaks up CO2 from the air. For now, solar radiation management is thought to be scientifically the sturdiest candidate. We know with 100% certainty that we can cool the planet, said Dr. Douglas McMartin, a Cornell University engineer. So why not do it now? Meddling with Mother Nature is risky. Earth's weather systems are interconnected in extremely complex ways, which is why climate change is believed to impact everything from how long hurricanes linger over coastlines to how fast wildfires accelerate. Tinkering with one aspect of weather could have dangerous, unforeseen ripple effects. 2 years ago, Nature called geoengineering outlandish and unsettling. Could blocking sunlight, for example, impact the Asian monsoon, which 2 billion people depend on for food crops, or alter the ocean's acidity? For geoengineering to be politically feasible, scientists would have to convince ordinary people that it's worth the calculated risk. Last year, Harvard sought to send a balloon into the stratosphere over Tucson in order to release small amounts of calcium carbonate, chalk, to test whether the reflected particles could block some sunlight, but the public outcry forced the experiment to be postponed. Is safety the only concern? No. Some climate activists argue that geoengineering serves as a get-out-of-jail-free panacea that would allow carbon-emitting corporations to conduct business as usual. They argue that no technological breakthrough would eliminate the long-term need to abandon fossil fuels. Raymond Pierre Humbert, a Nobel Prize-winning professor at Oxford University, compares relying on geoengineering without cutting emissions to jumping off the Washington Monument and hoping somebody invents anti-gravity before you hit the ground. Where do most scientists stand? The global failure to make major emissions cuts is causing many experts to reconsider geoengineering. Compared with the massive financial consequences of global warming, the estimated $2 billion annual price tag to develop solar engineering over 15 years is quite inexpensive. In March, an Australian team conducted one of the world's first geoengineering trials, using 100 nozzles to enhance existing clouds by blasting salt water into the air. In theory, it would take about 1,000 nozzles to save the entire Great Barrier Reef from dying off. People are right to fear over-reliance on techno-fixes, said Harvard professor David Keith. But there's another nightmare. We realize in hindsight that early use of geoengineering could have saved millions of lives lost in heat waves and help preserve some of the natural world. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First comes from David Brooks at the New York Times. Reality gap rooted in economic gulf. We're a country in epistemological crisis, said David Brooks, in which much of the Republican Party has become detached from reality. In vast numbers, Republicans believe Trump won the election. Climate change is fake news, and masks don't fight viral spread. The internet has enabled this corrosive spread of misinformation, but the root cause is the deep economic and cultural gap between the two Americas. On one side are moneyed information workers concentrated in ever more prosperous metro areas. On the other are people without college degrees facing flatter incomes, decimated families, dissolved communities. The precarity of their lives has sparked a fierce backlash against those with a lock on economic, cultural, and political power. Their resentment has been exploited by evangelists of distrust, from Donald Trump to QAnon promoters, whose conspiracy theories offer kinship with a community of believers and a sense of agency born of the power to reject experts and expose hidden cabals. How to combat this? You can't argue people out of paranoia. Instead, you must target the distrust and anxiety behind it through personal contact and reducing income inequality. That won't come easily. It is the work of a generation. The most valuable skill for immigrants. A new study has proven what generations of immigrants have known, said Jeff Jacoby. Learning English is the most valuable skill immigrants can acquire after arriving in the U.S. The study of 800 immigrants of various national origins by the Economic Mobility Corporation found that those who took government-subsidized English classes made up to $7,100 more per year than those who did not, and that their subsequent earnings grew at a faster rate. Speaking America's common tongue also means inclusion in the rich panoply of American life, including culture, entertainment, sports, and politics. A Pew Research poll found that 90% of U.S. residents of all ethnicities and races agree that to be truly American, people need to be able to speak English. During every wave of immigration going back to the 18th century, there has been fear that the U.S. would be taken over by non-English speakers. But contrary to what some people believe, immigrants today acquire proficiency in English faster than they did a century ago, and their children and grandchildren often speak it exclusively. We don't need a law establishing English as our national language because it always has been, and it seems safe to assume it always will be. This column comes from Ireland. Reinvent the city without cars. It's time to repurpose the hideous multi-level parking garage, said David McWilliams. Ireland is cluttered with these concrete monstrosities thanks to tax incentives that were introduced in 1995. With developers allowed to deduct up to 50% of construction cost, we saw an explosion of garage building, which resulted in cars saturating the city. Cork alone has 10 of these carbuncles, including that one on North Main Street that might get the prize for the ugliest urban structure in Ireland. Now that the coronavirus has halted commuting, these garages stand empty. Yet even when folks start heading back to offices, the green trend is pointing away from cars toward bicycles and buses. In other countries, multi-story car garages are being turned into retail outlets, artisan workshops, bars, cafes, and even clubs. Why not here? The Irish have done something similar before, when we found ourselves with a glut of abandoned churches. Those derelict houses of worship have been transformed into lecture halls, offices, and apartments. We could use tax breaks again. Only this time, incentives would go to developers who turn a garage into an urban farm or add a rooftop bar. In place of silent dead spaces, we can create warrens of activity, dynamic beehives of humanity, urban networks that are interdependent, and fully alive. We're on the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is Your Life or the Life of Your Child. When Leticia and her son, Yuvani, left Guatemala after gang threats and other violence, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post, they did not imagine the U.S. would tear them apart at the border. Leticia tells her story to anyone who will listen, judges, journalists, political officials. She recounts the moment she realized strangers had snatched her son while she slept in a migrant detention cell, and the agonizing month that followed when no one would tell her where her child was or whether he was even alive. Sharing this story is painful, but Leticia knows it would be more painful to still be living this experience, as hundreds of families are. because the U.S. government is, even today, separating families. For them, I would tell my story over and over again, she says. Before the country moves on, before the new administration and the public try to put this national atrocity in the rearview mirror, Letitia wants us all to remember. She wants us to provide what is owed to hundreds of children whose deported mothers and fathers haven't been located because the government didn't bother to keep records, and to the thousands more families who have been found and in some case reunited, but still fear for their lives. 3 years ago, Letitia and her son became victims of one of the largest-scale ethnically motivated human rights abuses perpetuated by the U.S. government since the Japanese internment. Today, they want to be advocates. I won't be calm or quiet until those parents can smile with their children, Letitia says. As for the U.S. officials responsible for this state-sanctioned child abuse, ultimately, we just want to hold them accountable so they can't do this in the future. In November 2017, Letitia and her son, Giovanni, then 15 years old, fled gang threats and other violence in Guatemala. The family spoke through an interpreter on the condition that the Washington Post not use their full names. They fear speaking publicly will lead to retaliation from U.S. immigration authorities and make it easier for gangs to find them. When they left Guatemala, they had no idea what horrors awaited them in the United States. After all, by reputation, law, and international treaty obligations, the United States is supposed to provide persecuted peoples the opportunity to seek asylum. When we crossed, we were actually a little happy, Letitia says now. We were a little happy because we thought the fear we felt had been left behind and that once we were in this country, they could no longer harm us. It was like, logically, we were safe. Instead, they were targeted by the Trump administration's El Paso pilot experiment to systematically separate parents from their children, a policy later expanded to the entire southern border. The goal, officials have said, was to make the process of seeking asylum, which is a legal right, so notoriously cruel that it would dissuade eligible families from even trying. A big name of the game is deterrence, then White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told NPR. A few hours after crossing the Rio Grande, Letitia and Giovanni were detained by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents and told they could sleep for a while. She was taken to a room for women, he to one for males. When she woke, other detainees said her son had been taken away. They didn't know where. Panicked, Letitia began pounding on the locked door, demanding to see her boy. A guard appeared, asking about the noise. She pleaded for her son. "I don't know where your son is. I don't know who your son is," she recalls him responding. "I'm just changing shifts." For a month, Letitia was in the dark. No one would tell her if Giovanni had been detained elsewhere, deported, or worse. Guards said it was her responsibility to locate him. They gave her a list of numbers for other detention centers, and she began calling around to see if one had her son. Eventually, she learned that Giovanni was in a shelter for unaccompanied children, and they were connected by phone. She urged him to eat and not to worry. She told Giovanni she was fine, even though daily crying fits had partially paralyzed her face. As time passed, her hopes faded. During a hearing, an immigration judge said that without legal representation, she had no chance of obtaining asylum, and she didn't know how to find a lawyer while still in detention. After 7 months, she agreed to relinquish her asylum claim and be deported back to Guatemala. She hoped that would better position Giovanni to at least be released from the shelter. Letitia and Giovanni agonized over whether he should go with her, given the death threats he faced back home. Ultimately, they decided he should stay and pursue his own asylum claim. He was a child. He had an entire life ahead of him, and he deserves to live, she recalls. You have to choose your life or the life of your child. Giovanni was placed with a foster family who arranged weekly phone calls between mother and son. They gave up on seeing each other again. Several months after returning to Guatemala, Letitia began getting calls from strangers, lawyers, nonprofits, and other volunteers trying to locate deported parents. She distrusted them and refused to talk. One day, however, a social worker showed up on her doorstep and convinced her that help was possible. Letitia was then connected with the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, which filed a motion to reopen her case. The group also asked Giovanni to write a letter to the government. In early 2020, a judge found that Letitia had been coerced into giving up her asylum claim and ordered that she be allowed back into the United States. After more than 2 years, mother and child were reunited. "It was almost like I was born again," she says. "I saw him enter. I thought, it was my son. It's my son." And at the same time, I hugged him. But I knew that I had a lot of pain and fear that they would take him away. I was hugging him so hard, but I thought they would separate us again. Of the several hundred parents deported without their kids, Letitia is among only about 20 who have been allowed back into the United States. According to Lee Gellert, an American Civil Liberties Union lawyer, and the lead attorney in litigation over family separations. Most are believed to be in Central America. Of those who have been located, roughly one-third subsequently chose to have their children deported, too. The others opted to leave their children in the States. Like Letitia, they feared repatriation would prove fatal. Today, Letitia and Giovanni live in New York City. While they are relieved to be together, being without her is like being a flower without water, Giovanni says. Anxiety over the separation persists. The pain, the lack of trust, and the trauma don't go away. Even when he goes to school and maybe he takes a little bit longer to get home, I get extremely nervous. She aches, too, for the parents still unable to see their children, including some being newly separated even today. There are multiple barriers to reunification. The Trump administration didn't track all the families, and what records it did keep are poor. As a result, the deported parents of 666 children, about 20% of whom were younger than five when separated, haven't even been located. The government isn't actively searching for these missing parents. Instead, Justice in Motion, a nonprofit that's part of an ACLU-organized steering committee, has dispatched contacts across remote and sometimes dangerous places to find them. The committee is paying for these search efforts itself. Traumatized parents may not trust those making contact, as Letitia can attest. She argues that parents already reunited should participate in these efforts to connect families. They say, "What are they calling me for? Are you calling me to deport my child? Or are they calling me to put me back in detention?" she explains. "We can be like a reflection for those parents and say, 'See, I was separated, but now I am reunited, and we want to help.'" Even when deported parents are located, there is usually little to offer them. Advocates are mostly trying to confirm that each child knows where their parent is, and each parent knows where their child is, said Christy Turner-Herbas, director of special programs at Kids in Need of Defense. Then deported parents are offered the unbearable choice between having their children deported to unsafe conditions and remaining apart. Having a more substantive remedy, she argues, would help get the word out. What kind of remedy? Mental health services are a good start. The White House tried to block a deal paying for therapy for separated families, NBC recently reported, but a judge ordered it anyway. So is some sort of broader financial restitution, perhaps through a victim's fund? There are already multiple lawsuits seeking recourse on behalf of families. At least 500 individuals, including Letitia, have also filed for monetary damages. Letitia's lawyers at the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project say the government has not responded to her administrative complaint filed in June 2019. Letitia argues such recourse is necessary to help injured families and to hold the government accountable. Perhaps more important than money is lawful status in the United States, where families can be safe. Anita Sinha, director of American University's International Human Rights Law Clinic, recently visited Honduras to help separated families document claims for monetary damages. When families realized the purpose of the visit and that they had no hope of receiving asylum, some almost walked out. No amount of money could help, she says. Even those already in the States, including families whose deportations a court temporarily blocked in 2018, are not secure. I think a lot of people don't realize that the Trump administration is still trying to deport these families, either the child alone or once reunited, says Gellert. So the trauma from the separations exists, but on top of that, there's the trauma of fighting for your life not to be sent back to danger. Victims like Letitia are still waiting for their asylum cases to be adjudicated. The Trump administration has severely restricted asylum eligibility, making it less likely such cases will succeed. Advocates argue that the incoming Biden administration should not only roll back Trump's asylum policies, but also secure separated families a faster path to residency. President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to create a task force for separated families. His transition team did not respond to questions about whether deported families should be allowed in the United States and whether Biden supports residency or other forms of redress for these victims. If Letitia could speak to Biden, she would ask him to pursue more humane immigration policies and to make amends for past mistakes. As for the rest of the country, her request is simple. Keep listening, but stop making it necessary for her to speak. This story was originally published in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries this week. The courtly Paul, who was NYC's first black mayor, David Dinkins, 1927 to 2020. When David Dinkins was elected New York City's first black mayor in 1989, he promised to bring healing calm to a troubled city. The crack epidemic was peaking, crime was rampant, and the city was reeling financially. Voters hoped Dinkins, a genteel career politician who favored tailored suits and who lauded New York's gorgeous mosaic, would usher in a less fractious era. That's not how things worked out. In the Democrats' first year, homicides hit a record high, and a black boycott of Korean-run stores inflamed racial tensions. Then, in 1991, a car driven by Hasidic Jew fatally struck a black child in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Crown Heights, setting off days of rioting, during which a rabbinical student was murdered. Widely condemned for his tepid response, Dinkins lost re-election bid to a pugnacious former U.S. attorney, Rudolph Giuliani. Mistakes were made, and I accept that, Dinkins said, though he later cited a different reason for his loss, racism, stirred by Giuliani. Dinkins was born in Trenton, New Jersey, where his father ran a one-chair barbershop, said the Washington Post. After high school, he joined the Marines, then studied mathematics at Howard University on the GI Bill. He married a classmate, Joyce Burroughs, and moved to Harlem, where her father was a businessman with political connections. After attending Brooklyn Law School while working nights in a liquor store, he became involved in clubhouse politics. His climb was slow and methodical, said the Los Angeles Times. In 1965, he won a state assembly seat, then served as city clerk and board of elections president. He ran three times for Manhattan borough president, finally winning in 1985. That office was a springboard for his run against Ed Koch, a once popular mayor who was seen as increasingly abrasive and divisive. After losing to Giuliani, Dinkins settled into a generally quiet private life, said the New York Daily News. He taught at Columbia University, hosted a radio talk show, and served on corporate boards. Later years brought increased appreciation of some of his mayoral achievements, including revitalizing Times Square. Dinkins showed us how to be a kind person no matter what was thrown at him, said New York's current mayor, Bill de Blasio. And a lot was thrown at him. Here's a health and science article. Did a viral mutation fuel the pandemic? A growing number of scientists suspect that a genetic mutation in the coronavirus during the early stages of the pandemic allowed the disease to spread around the world more rapidly than might otherwise have been possible, reports the New York Times. The virus has picked up thousands of mutations in its genetic code, and most have made no difference in its behavior. But one variant, known as 614G, first spotted in eastern China in January, has spread farther and faster than any other. Many scientists attribute this success to luck, saying the variant appeared by chance in large outbreaks like northern Italy's that seeded the disease elsewhere. But new research indicates 614G is more efficient at affecting people than the original variant from Wuhan, China. When UK scientists carried out a side-by-side comparison of how fast clusters of each variant grew, 614G had a 20% advantage in its exponential growth. Meanwhile, researchers in the U.S. have found that 614G is more infectious in samples of bronchial and nasal tissue and is more easily transmitted between hamsters during lab experiments. Scientists warn that another consequential mutation might emerge in the coming months. That could change the nature of the pandemic, said David Ingenthaler, a geneticist at the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Arizona. We have to listen to what the virus is telling us. And we're over on the Talking Points page. Georgia, will angry Republicans vote? President-elect Joe Biden's entire legislative agenda is hinging on Georgia, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. On January 5th, the state Biden stunningly won by barely 12,000 votes will hold two Senate runoff elections, and Democrats can swing the upper chamber of the Congress if John Ossoff and the Reverend Raphael Warnock defeat GOP incumbents David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. If both Democrats win, it will put the Senate at 50-50, with the Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote on legislation on a public health insurance option, green infrastructure spending, and a second coronavirus stimulus. If Republicans win either race, enabling Senator Mitch McConnell to remain as a stonewalling majority leader, forget all of it. To avoid this nightmare scenario, Georgia Democrats must again turn out in huge numbers. Republicans face their own turnout problem, said Benjamin Fernow in Newsweek.com. Trump's demoralized supporters in Georgia are being told that their votes in the Senate race can save America, while at the same time Trump insists that rigged voting machines and ballot fraud cost him Georgia and the election. Why would Trump supporters bother voting when the president insists the races are fixed? Indeed, some Georgia Republicans say they plan to boycott the runoffs or write in Trump's name as a protest. Trump is coming to campaign with Loeffler and Perdue, said Tina Nguyen and James Arkin in Politico.com. But GOP leaders are worried that during his visit, he'll amplify conspiracy talk. Doing so could shave off just enough MAGA voters to hand a tight race to the Democrats. The GOP must not take Georgia for granted, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. Pundits are convinced that Georgia is Republicans to lose, since conservatives are more inclined than progressives to to vote in runoff elections. GOP strategists think they can successfully cast Warnock and Ossoff as members of the radical left who want to defund the police. But Loeffler and Perdue, two of the wealthiest sitting senators, have their own baggage. Both have been accused of insider trading during the pandemic. Republicans remain confident that their rural and exurban voters will seize the chance to thwart Biden's liberal agenda. There's no guarantee, however, that Republicans can overcome their bitterness and show up to vote, even with such alarmingly high stakes. And we've just time for a couple of short pieces. The Atlantic hurricane season produced 30 named storms, the most in history. 12 of them made landfall, beating a record of 9 that's held since 1916, and 10 of them hit in September, a record for a single month. There were 6 major hurricanes of Category 3 or above. Joe Biden became the first presidential candidate in history to top 80 million votes this week as the counting of remaining ballots in several states continued. Biden amassed 6.2 million more votes than Donald Trump, with 51.1% of the total to Trump's 47.1%. And we'll finish out with a quote from novelist Pearl Buck, who says, "There is, of course, a difference between what a man seizes and what he really possesses." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.